Welcome to New Books and Biography. I'm Oline Eaton. Today I'm going to be talking with Ingrid Carlberg about her new book, Raoul Wallenberg, The Heroic Life and Mysterious Disappearance of the Man Who Saved Thousands of Hungarian Jews from the Holocaust. The winner of the August Prize for Nonfiction, the Axel Hirsch Prize for Biography, it was recently published this past March in English. Hi, Ingrid. Thank you so much for joining us for New Books and Biography. I wonder if you could just begin by telling us a bit about yourself.
Well, my name is Ingrid Carlberg. I live in Sweden. I'm the author of several nonfiction books. I've been a journalist in Sweden for 20 years, employed by the largest Swedish morning paper, Dagens Nyheter. And I am also honorary doctor at Uppsala University in Sweden.
So we biographers wind up spending a lot of time with the people that we're writing about. And I wonder, how did you first hear about Raoul Wallenberg and what drew you to him as a biographical subject?
Being a Swede, of course, the name Raoul Wallenberg was familiar to me. But I was struck a few years ago, or at least 7 years ago, I was struck by the fact that there was a certain silence around Raoul Wallenberg in Sweden, and that no one actually had produced the ambitious story on his life for a Swedish audience. There are not so many books written by Swedish authors about Raoul Wallenberg. I discovered that there were actually more books written about Raoul Wallenberg by foreign authors.
Oh, wow.
You get the impression that the interest might be even greater abroad. And that has several explanations, because in Sweden we have put a lot of attention to the post-war drama that surrounds Raoul Wallenberg, and throughout the years, not so much attention to what he really did in Budapest in the middle of, in the end of World War II, when he, during a period of 6 months, was one of those active diplomats who managed to save tens of thousands of Hungarian Jews. So there has been I would say, due to the fact that Raoul Wallenberg, the person in my book, was not only a hero during World War II, but ended up, was not only a hero during World War II, fighting against one of the world's most terrible tyrannies ever, the Nazi Germany. He ended up disappear and being a victim of the other disastrous tyranny the world knows about during the 20th century. I mean the Stalin's Soviet Union. And given the fact that Raoul Wallenberg disappeared and never returned to Sweden again, I would say that there are a certain amount of shame, political shame, when it comes to the Swedish dealing with the Raoul Wallenberg case in Sweden, and a very well-motivated political shame, because Sweden could have done a lot more to have him freed from his prison life in Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. And all this resulted in the fact that Raoul Wallenberg was in a way buried into a silence in Sweden, and I wanted just to tell his story, to learn him as a person, to get to know him as a person, to try to, we don't know so much about him. Who was Raoul Wallenberg before he left for Budapest to start with? So I decided to throw myself into a huge research project that hasn't been done in Sweden, to dig in all the archives, try to get close to the person Raoul Wallenberg, to what he really did in Budapest, behind the myths, and finally to reveal the whole tragic post-war story that actually isn't really solved, not yet really solved, but to put into to the public mind what Sweden were the diplomatic failures that Sweden, or I would rather put it as the Swedish diplomatic betrayal of Raoul Wallenberg, how this took place.
So for listeners who have no idea who we're talking about, could you just give us a quick overview of who he was?
Yeah, he was born in 1912. He's often portrayed by those who know him and know about him as the heir of a Swedish business dynasty, which is still a Swedish business dynasty today, that is linked to the Wallenberg family. They are the owner of a bank in Sweden and linked to this bank a lot of companies. So it's a huge business dynasty. He was not. He was you could say, quite distant to this rich family. So his future was not decided to be within the family empire. He was thus trying to make his way outside in the Swedish business life. So at the time in 1944, when he was appointed to the position in Budapest, he was a businessman importing food from Hungary, mainly poultry like turkeys and other poultries. but he also, he has a very peculiar background, because he had been studying abroad, which not many people know about. He had been studying in the United States for 3.5 years, studying architecture. He was interested in architecture and had a great artistic talent. So, but his main purpose in life was to succeed in business. So he was a businessman. But during the war, and especially in 1944, when Germany occupied Hungary, suddenly the disastrous humanitarian catastrophe, the Holocaust, came very close to Raoul Wallenberg, because he worked with a Hungarian, his boss at this Hungarian import-export firm was of Hungarian origin, and he was also Jewish. So suddenly, the problem, the mass deportations that came, that took place very soon after this, the German invasion of Hungary, became a very urgent matter for Raoul Wallenberg in his everyday life, and he ended up. Since he had this experience, he had been to Budapest several times. And when the American War Refugee Board searched for collaboration with neutral states in a very hastily decided rescue missions for Hungarian Jews in Hungary, Raoul Wallenberg ended up being the one who volunteered to take this position, to go down to Budapest and administer this Swedish-Hungarian rescue mission. So he was appointed a second secretary at the Swedish legation and suddenly became a diplomat without any diplomatic experience whatsoever. But his main mission was to administer this rescue mission with money from the United States and the diplomatic formal position from Sweden. And that's what he did during 6 months. And after, when the Russians came to Budapest, the Russian troops arrived in Budapest in January 1945, he believed that he could seek collaboration with the the Soviet army in rescuing two ghettos in Budapest. But he made a misjudgment there. He voluntarily seeked contact with them, but he ended up arrested. And he was taken to Lubyanka prison in Moscow and ended up imprisoned. We know that he was alive for 2.5 years, but during which time he might have been released, of course, but he never came back to Sweden. So his death, and we still don't know exactly what happened to him.
Mm-hmm. So this brings up an interesting point, that gaps are a special challenge to a biographer. So how do you deal with that? Because here you've got a story with an unclear ending, but were there also any other especially perplexing points in the story of his life that that you sort of struggled to fill or figure out what happened?
Yeah, there were a lot of gaps in his life, not only the period after he disappeared. I tried to reconstruct, you know, you try to find all possible archives that could shade light, it'll give light on certain periods. And there was a problematic period I remember from like the 7 years before he left. When he was still abroad studying, he wrote a lot of letters. So you got his personal descriptions of his stay in the United States, for example, or even during his childhood, there were a lot of letters written. But when he returned to Stockholm in the end of the 30s, he ended his letter writing because all his relatives were in Sweden. It had, before I wrote this book, been quite unclear what both his personal life before he left and his professional life. His sister, his half-sister, 95 years old, is still alive and was, of course, also when I wrote the book. So I started by visiting her for lengthy interviews, 2 hours every second week. She was old, so we couldn't talk longer than 2 hours every time. But she told me that I don't know enough when it comes to his professional life. And I have the memories from his personal life, of course, when he came back to Sweden, but not enough. And then she told me, I think you should call his cousin. He's 100 years old, but please do. And I told myself, you don't call a person who's 100 years old. So I remember that I hesitated for a couple of weeks, and then I started to try to find a relative who could tell me how to move forward. Mm-hmm. And when I finally found a relative to this 100-year-old cousin, he said, oh, Lennart, that was his name, mm-hmm. just call him. And then I called the 100-year-old Lennart, and Lennart said, oh, well, let's see, next week, Wednesday, could you come in the morning? Because in the afternoon I have a meeting in town. And then I went to Lennart, and he had kept for all his life a certain amount of letters between him and Raoul Wallenberg, photos from their weekends out with his sailing boat in the Stockholm archipelago.
Oh, wow.
And he had decided, I am 100 years old, this seems to be a serious woman. So he allowed me to scan all this, and I could, better than before, fill gaps during that period. So that is just an example.
Mm-hmm.
You need to be lucky, but you also need to work hard and follow every trace to fill those gaps.
Yeah. This is really one of the joys about working in fairly recent history, is that there are still people who you can interview. And that's such an enriching project, I find, to the work that we can produce, is speaking to people who have memories of it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But still, I always blame myself for not having this idea earlier.
Yeah.
When, you know, I started to my research on this book in 2009. And I think 1 month before I learned about the death of Raoul Wallenberg's half brother, and I hadn't yet been in contact with him. I phoned him, as I understand, nearly the same day as he died, mm-hmm. and then you start to question, why has no one done this in depth from a Swedish perspective? Because it's only if you live in the country and if you speak the language that you can do the deep research that is necessary to depict this in my person, Raoul Wallenberg.
Mm-hmm. Were there any other sources that were especially helpful? Are there archives and institutions?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Private archives. Mm-hmm. I used a lot of private archives, the archives of Raoul Wallenberg's closest family, his half-sister. They have also gathered a lot of material in the Swedish National Archives on Raoul Wallenberg, a private archive on Raoul Wallenberg in Stockholm. You do, of course, have the whole huge Swedish Foreign Ministry Act on Raoul Wallenberg and his disappearance. You have the telegrams between Sweden and Budapest when it comes to the rescue mission. You have the Russian archives. We had a period in the beginning of the 90s when after Glasnost, when Soviet Union, later Russia, which was transformed to Russia during this period, when they decided to open their archives, not independently, but they decided to release a certain amount of documents as a result of the Glasnost, mm-hmm. trying to close the case of Raoul Wallenberg, which has been a deep political wound as well as a diplomatic bilateral crisis between Sweden and Soviet Union for today 70 years, but at that time 50 years. So there were an interesting amount of documents released in the beginning of the 90s before the Russian archives were closed again. Mm-hmm. And after that, we haven't really got anything new out of just some very small details, but no new documents of importance from the Russian archives. But that pile of documents was also very important, of course. Finally, I would like to mention the discovery of Raoul Wallenberg's stepfather. His own father died before he was born, so he never met his own father. But he when he was 6 years old, his mother remarried, so he grew up with a stepfather, and his name was Fredrik von Dardel. He decided after a while to write a diary on the search for Raoul Wallenberg. Mm. So all what the family did to try to get him released, and their problems to deal with the Swedish Foreign Ministry, who was hesitant, too hesitant all the time, you can follow that process in his extremely moving diaries, where he had added all outgoing, all copies of outgoing and incoming letters. So it's a huge archive, and it's really a if you want to depict this post-war drama, even from the family's private view, that was really something. Mm-hmm.
So as we've mentioned, this is a story that has an unclear ending. And I wondered, how did you deal with that specifically when you were trying to sort of shift the gaze forward into the pre-war life? And also that it's a story that's ongoing in some respects, because there's still information coming. I think I saw that last week there was a filing of paperwork to have him declared legally dead. So how do you manage the various tensions there in the storytelling? How did you deal with that?
I decided quite early that I needed to depict his life story in the most thrilling way I know mm-hmm. of, and that is, of course, the chronological. And I wanted to do, I have written a narrative, which is, it can be read like, it's nonfiction, but it's storytelling. But I, in the same way, as same time as I wanted to write the story as a, it can be read as a thriller, you could say so, but everything is based on fact. So I have a footnote to every claim I make. If I write that he suddenly hesitated, then I know that from something he has written in a letter. So I was very keen to go very, very close to facts, not to, you know, create dialogues, etc. And when I decided to write this story chronologically, I had the problem you mentioned. How do I deal with this unclear ending? How do I deal with the facts that have come later on when I do depict the very moment? And I could then just tell you that the traces from Raoul Wallenberg ends in 1947. We know today that he lived up until 1947, but we don't know. And there are claims from the Russian side that he that came later on in 1957. They for the first time admitted that Raoul Wallenberg had been in a Soviet prison. Up until then, they didn't admit that Raoul Wallenberg even was known to them. Mm-hmm. So I had to deal with the fact that when I write about 1947. I know that I know what the truth, the claim that will come in 10 years, but how do I write about it then? And I decided never to lose track on the chronological, what to say, the pace, mm-hmm. but to add known facts from later on, to the story. That made it possible for me, for example, to write about his life in prison. Mm-hmm. Although in 1947 we didn't know that, but we know it from later. I don't know if this is an answer to your question, but
yes, no, it is. Yeah.
And then I when I came to the very date of the 17th July 1947, when the Russians still today claim that he died a natural death, I just took out the facts that were undisputable. Mm-hmm. So what do we know? And then I wrote the story on the facts we know. And I also chose to in my book, to add between the chronological chapters some, I could call it more journalistic visits, where I depict my research and my meetings in short passages in present time, and I could also deal a bit with what later happened in those short passages between the chronological story, mm-hmm. and I've tried to create a tension there so it would be clear for the reader. You are the one to decide if I managed.
No, that was actually, this is going to be my next question, was about the structure of the book, and in particular how it's divided into the three parts with the questions, what makes a person, what makes an act heroic, and what determines a person's fate, and then also the insertion of the passages in the present day, which I thought were really cool. But I was curious how you came to settle upon this as a way to tell the story.
Confronted with this huge perspective of depicting such a long period, I wanted to tell the story from his birth up until today. I was faced with the question on how to structure it, of course. And I realized after a while that I wanted to write the book in three parts, which is not that sensational, not such a sensational idea maybe, but that I would divide the story into three parts of equal size when it came to pages and how length of the story in my book. So basically, if it's a book on it's about 600 pages, then I would devote 200 pages to each part. And the first part, I decided, would ask the question, what makes a person? Because to understand who the person Raoul Wallenberg was in Budapest in 1944, you need to follow him. What created him? What kind of details in his life decided the kind of personality he was, which made it possible for him to do what he did in Budapest? Mm-hmm. And I decided that this must be the first part, up until his departure for Budapest. What makes a person? And this part thus covers 31 and a half, or 32 years, basically. Mm-hmm. So he was very young. He was only 32 years during this 6 months in Budapest, which you don't really realize. Yeah. And then the second part, that I decided to cover his period in Budapest in that part and ask and address the part. I also decided to address the part with each part with a question. So the first question was, what makes a person? The second question I raised for myself was, what makes an act heroic? Mm-hmm. Or what is an heroic act? And that is where I tried to go behind the myth in Budapest. And this part of the book covers only 6 months, but it's 200 pages. So it's the drama in Budapest, and where I try to understand what kind of heroism, what was the kind of heroism that was Raoul Wallenberg's, or Raoul Wallenberg's deeds in Budapest. And it's a chronological story on what happened and the actions that he did and did not do, et cetera, et cetera. And then the third part had to be the post-war story, the story after his disappearance. And that part is also 200 pages long, but it covers 70 years. Mm-hmm. So, and the question I raise there is, what determines a person's fate?
So did you start with the research with these questions already in mind?
No, they came after a while.
Okay.
When I started to think about the structure.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that I, to myself, when I did the research, these were the questions that made me move forward.
Right.
Mm-hmm. To start with the question, who he really was,
mm-hmm.
What makes a person, all the kind of details in the life that implicates or that influence you and that creates the kind of grown-up personality. And I think there were a lot of things in his background that created the personality
mm-hmm.
he was. So I suddenly one day I said, but these questions that I asked myself, my own main questions, must be the three parts of the book.
Mm-hmm. It's a really great organizational structure. It makes it really interesting. So what do you see as his legacy?
I think it's, in a way, it's not the kind of legacy that is usually linked to Raoul Wallenberg.
Mm-hmm.
It's often said that about Raoul Wallenberg, that one person can make a difference. And that is true. He was, in a way, it's true. But it's not his legacy to me. Because what he did when he came to Budapest was to show the strength of collective work. He was an organizer. He built an organization that was very well functioning in Budapest during these chaotic circumstances. In the end, he had 350 persons employed, and he also collaborated with other neutral diplomats in an effort that mainly has as its heroic countenance this collaboration and this collective and the bureaucratic triumph. You could say that he managed to to confront Eichmann's evil bureaucracy with a bureaucracy of good. So he dealt, the way he dealt with the situation, the way he organized his rescue efforts, the way he showed that when the tens of thousands of people are fleeing from absolute evil, when at this point you cannot stay with political talks or negotiations. You have to act to organize and deliver help for people on site. He decided, he demonstrated that in a very clear manner. And I think that today, when you view upon what's happening today in the largest refugee crisis we have since World War II, this is exactly what lacks. We have a lot of political declarations. We have a lot of roundtables and long discussions and strange political decisions. But this ability to act, to organize, is not that impressive.
Okay, well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for calling me.
I've been listening to an interview with Ingrid Carlberg about her new book, Raoul Wallenberg, The Heroic Life and Mysterious Disappearance of the Man Who Saved Thousands of Hungarian Jews from the Holocaust. I'm Olayne Eaton. This is New Books and Biography. Thanks for listening.